order was of any good. It was evil, it was corrupt, it was unjust, and it was for the few. For a few in Europe, a small minority in Europe and North America, and their allies, whether in Australia or New Zealand or elsewhere. They dominated the world. They crushed resistance. They crushed the global South, whether through sanctions, whether through war, whether through unjust laws, through the UN and other international bodies. They continued to accumulate wealth and power for themselves. But now that regime, that idea, that empire is collapsing. It's collapsing because of its own contradictions and because of the resistance that exists. And I think that the most important resistance, the most important ideological resistance in the global South is what we see in our regional resistance. And therefore, I personally believe that we are entering a very different world, a very different era. And it's difficult to predict what will happen. But as long as there are those people whose minds have been decolonized, despite the hardship, despite the incompetence of many, and despite the antagonism of the declining empire, I think that there is a great deal of hope for the future.
Thank you very much, Mohammad Marandi, Professor of International Studies at the University of Tehran. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and views with us. And let's take a look at some other reports that our team has prepared regarding the 33rd anniversary of the demise of Imam Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
A spiritual leader who maintained a simple lifestyle. Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini was born in the city of Khomein on September 24, 1902. He grew up in a family with a long tradition of religious scholarship. He received early Quranic education at home and local schools, and pursued his later studies at Islamic seminaries until he became marja, or a source of emulation, a highly prominent authority in religious law. Imam Khomeini soon rose to fame as an anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism icon. He became politically active when, in 1963, the then US-backed monarch of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, launched a program of reforms known as the White Revolution. The plan was an American-inspired package of measures designed to prop up the regime and nip any voices of dissent in the bud, all in the name of promoting the rights of citizens. Imam Khomeini was the first religious leader who openly condemned the Shah's program of westernization. That opposition led to protests against the monarch. In response, the Pahlavi regime launched a brutal crackdown and arrested Imam Khomeini. His detention resulted in an uprising in June 1963. Demonstrators were confronted by tanks and troops armed to the teeth. Thousands were killed. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile, this time because he had opposed the legal immunity the Shah had granted to American military personnel in Iran. He spent over 14 years in exile, mostly in the holy city of Najaf in Iraq. But that didn't stop him from criticizing the Shah for making concessions to Western powers, in his view, a violation of Iranian sovereignty. People from all walks of life listened to his speeches via cassettes and distributed his letters, which became the bedrock of a budding revolution. In the early 1970s, Imam Khomeini gave a series of lectures in Najaf on the establishment of a system based on Islamic values. Those lectures were later published as a book under the title Guardianship of the Islamic Jurists. This was his most famous and influential work. It laid out his ideas on a system of governance that would end dictatorship, establish Sharia or Islam's divine law, and would fight injustice, corruption, and oppression. Imam Khomeini's courage, charisma, and popularity opened a new chapter in a grassroots resistance against the Pahlavi regime. Ultimately, on the 16th of January 1979, the Shah fled Iran, and on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned from Nafel Le Chateau in France, where he'd been living in exile. 10 days later, Iranians celebrated as their revolution culminated in the overthrow of the US-backed Pahlavi regime. In March 1979, more than 98% of Iranians voted in favor of an Islamic Republic in a referendum. Under such a system proposed by Imam Khomeini, Iran is considered a sovereign country in the form of a republic that implements Islamic laws. A system in marked contrast to the dictatorial Pahlavi regime that was totally dependent on the West, in particular the United States.
Well, dear listeners, this was the live special coverage on the 33rd passing away anniversary of the late founder of Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. God's mercy upon him.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran says a visit by the IAEA chief to Israel just ahead of a meeting of the Board of Governors could erode the agency's credibility. Yemenis rally in major cities in protest against 7 years of Saudi-led war and blockade. Also ahead, 100 days into the war in Ukraine, both Moscow and Kiev renew their pledges to fight on for victory. It's good to have you with us. Tehran reacts after the controversial visit by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency to Israel days after criticism of Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Iran's foreign ministry warns of further erosion of the agency's credibility, while its Director General kept silent on Israel's secret nuclear arsenal. Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says this questions the IAEA's impartiality. Iran is one of the signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel, however, has never signed up to the treaty that aims to ensure civilian use of nuclear technology. The regime backs a draft resolution prepared by the U.S. and its allies to rebuke Iran by the IAEA Board of Governors. Tehran has warned against any unconstructive action at the upcoming meeting of the body, saying it will respond immediately and proportionately. Iran's president says the admission by Washington that a maximum pressure campaign against the country has failed means that the Iranian nation has defeated the United States. Ibrahim Raisi made a comment ahead of the 33rd anniversary of the passing away of the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. The president hailed Imam Khomeini as a leader who always stood up to arrogant powers, including the U.S. He added that the late Imam's teachings have inspired the Iranian nation to make remarkable progress over the past decades.
150 foreign ambassadors and officials have visited Tehran to take part in the 33rd anniversary of the passing away of a man who changed the course of history in Iran, Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini was the founder of the Islamic Republic and the former leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which put an end to centuries of autocracy in Iran. Here, people believe the scale of Imam Khomeini's impact transcends Iran's boundaries.
The Islamic Revolution of Iran has proved to the Nigerian populace that if you are determined to eliminate any unjust leader and you follow the course, you can reach a result in some of the curriculum of the higher education in Nigeria. There are some space being open for Imam Khomeini to talk about the Imam Khomeini and the revolution of Islamic Republic in Nigeria curriculum of education.
Thanks to Imam Khomeini, we have witnessed a freedom-seeking movement forming in Muslim and even non-Muslim nations, which challenges imperialism and encourages dignity and independence from the global arrogance. This is the miracle of the Islamic Revolution.
Imam Khomeini passed away in 1989 at the age of 86, almost a decade after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, which saw the overthrow of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime in Iran, headed by Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, known as the Shah. Imam Khomeini spent many years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately ousted the Shah and led to the formation of the Islamic Republic.
For us, Imam Khomeini is a model.
For us, Imam Khomeini is a role model of resilience in the face of injustice. Today, we have come to renew our allegiance with him and the lessons that he taught us about self-reliance and resistance against the bullies of the world.
Imam Khomeini established the Islamic Republic following a referendum held in 1979, when, based on official reports, more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic.
Imam Khomeini is remembered here as the pioneer of a new era in Iran's history, an era that put centuries of monarchy behind and upended the Shah's domestic and foreign policies, replacing them with a political system that tries to rule the country based on the motto of independence from the West. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghans have held a ceremony in Kabul to mark the 33rd passing away anniversary of the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. As Rahmatullah Baghwan reports, participants in the ceremony renewed their allegiance to his school of thought.
Afghans gathered to pay tribute to Imam Khomeini, the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic. The participants described Imam Khomeini as a symbol of unity, justice, devotion, and honesty.
Imam Khomeini managed to establish a government on the basis of Islamic values and toppled a Western-backed monarchy. His revolution not only affected Iran, but also brought huge changes in the region and beyond. Imam Khomeini made the new century an era of the failure of evil's hegemony and advancement of Islam.
Imam Khomeini was the leader of the Islamic world and the oppressed. His ideology included solidarity among Muslims. Imam's path was a path of right and prophets. We Muslim girls and youth are holding such events to honor his thought and revolution and renew our allegiance. All these girls are his daughters as they are following his roadmap.
Afghan speaker said resisting arrogance and fighting for an Islamic and independent government were among the main lessons they learned from Imam Khomeini's school of thought.
One of the heroic characteristics of Imam Khomeini was drawing the roadmap of fighting arrogance. Imam Khomeini taught the world to stand against oppression and arrogance. He also stressed that we keep this spirit alive.
Every year, Afghans commemorate Imam Khomeini as a leader who initiated Islamic Republic government, stood for the oppressed, and inspired others to fight arrogance.
Afghans remember Imam Khomeini as a great leader. People here say they owe their freedom to the Imam's thoughts and efforts. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thousands of Yemenis take to the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities, including Sa'da and Hajja, in a public display of the nation's resolve against the Saudi-led war on the country. Demonstrators with Yemen's flag chanted the slogans against the aggressors and their key ally, the United States. The Yemenis were on the streets to make it clear to the enemies that their country will remain independent and free. Demonstrations were held in honor of the late founder of Ansarullah movement, Hussein al-Houthi. The demonstrators also slammed dishonest calls for peace made by certain Arab governments that have normalized relations with the Israeli regime. The Yemenis reiterated their support for the Palestinian cause. UN envoy for Yemen Hans Grundberg says parties of the war in Yemen have agreed to extend the truce for another 2 months. Analysts say the agreement could pave the way for ending the conflict. Abdul Latif al-Bashiri reports from Sana'a.
Following intense UN-supervised meetings between the warring sides in Yemen, the UN envoy for Yemen announced that the parties have agreed to renew the current truce in Yemen for 2 more months. The truce is extended under the same terms as the original agreement, which first came into effect on the 2nd of April.
When the United Nations agreed to our conditions, which included releasing the salaries of government employees, we saw that it was our duty to respond to the renewal of the truce, although we were aware that the enemy would not respect the truce as it did previously. But we adhere to peaceful solutions and we will make concessions in order to end the war.
Observers say renewing the truce is a win for the Yemenis, who stood alone during 7 years of war without any support from the international community or the United Nations.
The United Nations was absent throughout the years of war, and the armistice is not an achievement for the international body, but rather a success for Sana'a, which remained alone in facing war and siege without any support from the international community or any allies.
Grundberg said he will continue engaging with the parties to implement and consolidate all elements of the truce.
People, he hoped that renewing the UN brokered truce will build for a comprehensive political solution to end the war that devastated their lives and country. They say the international community should now step in properly to support the political process in Yemen. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
100 days into the war in Ukraine, Russia says it will continue its military operation until all its goals are achieved. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says one of Moscow's main goals is to protect people of the self-proclaimed republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. With war raging in eastern Ukraine, Peskov says Russia has achieved certain results. He says these include what he called the liberation of some areas from Ukrainian military control. However, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky pushed back, pledging victory against Russian forces. Moscow launched a military operation in Ukraine on February 24th. It came after the United States and its allies ignored Moscow's complaints about NATO's expansion near Russian borders. Anti-war demonstrations have been held in Italy, with protesters calling on the government to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and leave NATO. The initiatives took place while the Italian authorities were celebrating the 76th anniversary of the Republic. Here's more.
June the 2nd is the day Italy celebrates becoming a republic. On this day, in a referendum held in 1946, Italians opted to abolish the country's short-lived monarchy and adopt a republican form of government. Every year, the celebrations feature large military and official parades along the ancient Roman Forum in the presence of the highest offices of the state. Never before have controversies over the military parade been this contentious, with anti-war demonstrations held in a number of Italian cities, including Bologna, Padua, and Bari.
We are here to protest against the government's decision to send weapons to Ukraine and to stage a military parade on our Republic Day, while there is a war raging on in Europe.
One of the anti-war protests was held in central Rome, 500 meters away from the Republic Day celebrations. The initiative had been called by the base union USB and political party Power to the People.
Enough with military escalation in Ukraine, which is mainly in the interest of the US. Italy and the EU are not protecting people's interests. Most people don't want this war. We have to leave NATO, ASAP, and the Draghi government must go now.
Since the start of the Ukraine conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown over half of the Italians oppose sending weapons to Kyiv and believe sanctions against Russia are useless. Protesters are angered not only over the Mario Draghi government's military spending on Ukraine, which they say would be better spent on raising workers' wages. They are also opposing the government's decision to raise military expenditure from 1.4 to 2% of the country's GDP.
Una scelta criminale.
This is a criminal choice. It's unbelievable. After years of slashing the welfare state, shame on the government.
Io non ho una pregiudiziale.
I don't have anything against arms spending if weapons are used for defense purposes, not to fight proxy wars or to pillage other countries.
According to studies carried out by a number of Italy-based think tanks, Italians have never been eager to increase defense expenditures. Based on data from the 1950s to date, on average, less than 20% of respondents believe that military spending is too low or should be increased. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, as I said earlier, the UN envoy for Yemen has said that the parties involved in the war in Yemen have agreed to extend the truce for another 2 months. Now, to discuss that further, I'm joined by Abdellatif Al-Washili, our correspondent in Sana'a. Abdellatif, thank you for joining us. It's good to talk to you. How helpful has this 2 month truce been in terms of improving the humanitarian conditions and reducing civilian casualties in Yemen?
Thank you so much for having me. Actually, Yemenis aren't really optimistic about the truce, even though they know that the Saudi Arabia coalition will keep breaching the terms of the armistice as it has been doing during the past 2 months. They have been detaining oil ships. They have also been conducting some military actions using drones, using also waging some air strikes on several areas. They know all of that, but they are really optimistic as they have been under siege and war for 7 years. Now we can see some oil deliveries are getting to the country through Hodeidah port. This is very good for the Yemeni people, especially for the health sector, also for the for all the vital sectors of the country. They believe that it also can be a beginning to an end for this war that have been that has killed thousands or tens of thousands of civilians, including women and the children. Now we don't see people being killed by airstrikes, but also the health sector is still suffering. You can't help the sector and get it back as it was at least in 2 months. We need a long time to get everything back, and the Yemenis are looking forward if this truce will be permanent and the oil deliveries will be larger in larger quantities getting to the country, and also opening Sana'a airport on a daily basis as it was before the war. Now we have limited flights, and I've asked some people why didn't they travel to their destination. They said that they are afraid if they go to Egypt or Jordan and then they cannot go back if the airport is closed. They are still afraid, even though everything, but the situation is getting better, actually.
Thank you so much, Abdellatif Al-Washili. Hopefully, the war will come to an end soon. That was Abdellatif Al-Washili, your correspondent in Sana'a. Turkey's inflation rate hit 73.5% in May, the highest since 1998. The high inflation is blamed on soaring food and energy prices. Official data showed food prices rose by 91.6% year-on-year in May, while transport climbed by 107.6%. Critics believe the economic crisis is associated with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's monetary policy of pushing for lower interest rates. Moreover, the currency has lost more than 48% of its value over the past year. The Turkish lira further fell against the dollar on Friday and now stands at 16.49, amid rumors of a military intervention in northern Syria. The French government has effectively declared that the existing economic woes in that country will last for years. Inflation has been unprecedented, and it may not be over until 2024. That could cause major problems for recently re-elected President Emmanuel Macron. That's a wrap for this hour's World News. Thanks for your company. We'll be right back.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full, in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
Imam Khomeini's 33rd passing away anniversary. With a calm and sure heart, a happy spirit, and an inward hopeful of God's favor, I take leave of brothers and sisters and travel to the eternal abode, while I am in dire need of your good prayer. And I appeal to the compassionate and merciful God to accept my shortcomings in serving you. These were the words of Imam Khomeini's testament. The great leader of the Islamic Revolution spent his whole life in the way of God and salvation of not just Muslims, but the oppressed and downtrodden all over the world, yet He asks people to pray for him so that God accepts his shortcomings in fulfilling his duties. Dear listeners, today is the 33rd anniversary of Imam Khomeini's departure from the mortal world. We have prepared a special program on this occasion. Stay with us, please. The first days of the month of Khordad of the Iranian calendar year 1368, late May and early June of 1989, were very hard for the Iranian nation and the lovers of Imam Khomeini. The conditions of Imam Khomeini were deteriorating, and people from all walks of life had gathered at mosques, religious places, and even houses to plead God for the Imam's health. They asked God to cut their life and add to Imam Khomeini's life. But alas, the heart of the greatest leader of the Islamic Ummah and the oppressed in the world in the modern times stopped beating on June 4th, 1989, only to plunge in sorrow the whole Iranian nation and freedom seekers in the Islamic Ummah and across the world. Now, 33 years into the harrowing demise of Imam Khomeini, his lovers swarm around his shrine in southern Tehran to revive their pledge of allegiance with the unmatched leader of the Islamic Ummah and the downtrodden masses throughout the world. Imam Khomeini has gone, but his ideals and aspirations for mankind are alive forever. Most people will be cast into oblivion, or at least turn into a dim and picture. But people like Imam Khomeini not only are not forgotten, but also they become brighter and brighter as time passes. Imam Khomeini passed away 33 years ago, but his thoughts and guidelines keep leading and empowering the seekers of truth, justice, and freedom all over the world. He showed the way for struggling against the bullies and oppressors across the world. One of the important characteristics of Imam Khomeini's school was to stand firmly against the influence of foreigners and non-compromise with superpowers. Many people in history have fought injustice, while later on they became oppressors themselves. But according to Imam Khomeini's school, fighting injustice is accompanied by fighting the self and extremist desires of the self and humbleness before God as the supreme power. Imam Khomeini never separated these two battlefields. He stood against arrogant powers while struggling against his self and mean desires. Exactly for this reason, his lifestyle never changed when he took the helms of power as the leader of the Islamic Ummah. He and the students of his school have marched in the name of God and for God's sake. One of the main goals of Imam Khomeini was to return the Iranian nation and the Islamic nations to their origins in order to know the advanced Islamic culture and familiarize others with this glorious culture. His top aspiration was to free Muslims from the yoke of the decadent and corrupt Western culture. Imam Khomeini planted self-belief and self-confidence in the hearts of Muslims to find their brilliant identity. He said, "The main thing is to prepare the minds of these youths and even old ones and intellectuals to believe that we are humans rather than stretching our hands towards others for everything. If you believe that you are humans and have the ability to think, you will be successful." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, believed that every Muslim, especially scholars, are duty-bound to serious struggle against the capitalist and communist policies. Today, the Islamic Revolution is the only independent revolution in the world. That's why those who want to fight the domineering system take the role model of Iran. For sure, this has infuriated the US, Britain, and their allies. Imam Khomeini clearly proved that the men of God do not fear anyone but God. He would prudently ponder over events and circumstances and would try to provide the conditions on the way of his goal. In his testament, he first mentions and explains Hadith Saqalain, two weighty and precious things in the meaning, namely the Noble Quran and the progeny of the Prophet of Islam as the sources of guidance and salvation in this world and the hereafter. In this viewpoint, ruling according to the religious and spiritual values will never capitulate to the desires of oppressors and tyrants. Thus, such a rule will endanger the interest of the domineering powers. The Imam, addressing all people, writes in his testament, "Remembering Almighty God, advance toward self-recognition, self-sufficiency, and independence with all its dimensions, as God's hand is no doubt with you." Ayatollah Khamenei says on Imam Khomeini, "He was like a son which clarifies the objects with its radiance, and was like a spirit which revives the organs through breathing into the body. He revives us and caused us to move, and we were able, with his help, to realize the historical and geographical value of our country and the reality of our past culture and the reality of Quran."
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Person who said that we will defend our country and defend our people. The most important job for the President of the United States is defend our people from attack.
The front line. Part one.
I'm very worried about the future. Is not the Taliban, it's not terrorists, because the Taliban and terrorists, they can be contained. But when you have 1 million of your citizens addicted to drug, it is a national crisis.
According to the 2013 survey by the U.S. Department of State, there are more than 1,300,000 drug addicts in Afghanistan. 300,000 of them children. It's been predicted that the number will double in the not too distant future.
The youth population are very vulnerable to being addicted to drugs. So because of the demography of Afghanistan, we are the second youngest nation in the world. It will be a serious strategic security and social threat to Afghanistan.
Since the early 21st century, Afghanistan has been the world's largest opium producer. That's while in the early 1980s, poppy cultivation in this country was very limited and only for domestic use. Despite 30 years of war, the country has seen a steep rise in opium poppy culture and the proliferation of heroin processing laboratories. The question is, what can link war in this war-stricken country to growing poppies? The Opium War, which was fought between Great Britain and China in the 19th century, was a classic example of forcing a country to produce and use opium. But in our time, war and opium were glued together once again in the Golden Triangle. A group of three countries in Southeast Asia: Myanmar, Laos, and Thailand. This triangle of opium production was formed in the late 1950s to supply most of the world's heroin for three decades. Intelligence organizations and the Western Mafia played a key role in expanding and supporting this area. The aim was to finance the Vietnam War through drug trade. As the war came to an end, poppy cultivation in the Golden Triangle went down drastically. The drug mafia needed a new land and labor for opium production. From the 1980s, the opium industry shifted from the Golden Triangle into Afghanistan. The shift was made after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. At the time, the United States, with the help of the intelligence service of Pakistan, waged a cold war of poppy cultivation to fund the CIA secret missions in supporting Afghan Mujahideen and fighting the Soviet Union. In 2 years, the border areas between Afghanistan and Pakistan became the world's biggest producer of heroin. And Afghan leaders and local groups on Pakistan border and later in the south of this country set up thousands of heroin processing labs. In Pakistan, the number of drug addicts from nearly zero in 1979 surpassed 1,200,000 in 1985. Opium production soared non-stop even after the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan. The Taliban worked in close cooperation with the CIA till the 9/11 attacks. However, after NATO won the 2001 war, a number of prominent Afghans met in Bonn, Germany, to develop a plan to re-establish the state of Afghanistan. The result was the Bonn Agreement. As part of that agreement, the Blair government was designated to address counter-narcotics issues in Afghanistan. The Taliban was blamed for producing and smuggling drugs. In 2001, as the Taliban rule came to an end, opium production fell to 200 tons that year. But with the presence of NATO and the establishment of a permanent government in the country, opium production rose to 3,400 tons and 3,600 tons in the next 2 years. The year 2007 saw a record level of opium production with 8,200 tons, which was a twofold increase compared to the year 2005. For years, it was assumed that devastating wars and political instability were the root causes of opium production during the Taliban rule. But as statistics show, neither NATO nor the central government in Afghanistan could bring the production to a halt. According to the 2013 annual report of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, the UNODC, poppy cultivation has increased 36% in provinces of Farah, Helmand, Kandahar, and Uruzgan in the south and east of Afghanistan. That's while opium production has increased 50% compared with the last year.
The main problem is only in one third of the provinces which happen to be neighbor of Pakistan's. And those provinces, the Afghan governments and the international community, they do not have sufficient presence.
Why has this area developed such potential for producing three-fourths of the world's opium? Some believe that insecurity, opium and terrorism have formed a sinister triangle in the country. And before anything else, measure must be taken to restore security and order in the country. But neither NATO nor the central government has been successful in this regard. Why? The UNODC has estimated the drug money in Afghanistan from 2001 to 2010 to be around $68 billion. The income from opium production is shared between different groups. Again, according to the UNODC, $2 billion in opium profits goes into the pockets of the groups inside Afghanistan, and $66 billion goes to the drug mafia outside the country. That's while around $200 million goes to the armed insurgents. So three different groups catch fish from the murky water. First, the powerful drug mafia outside Afghanistan. Second, the Taliban and armed insurgents. And third, Afghan drug traffickers, farmers. From 2012 to 2013, crop eradication programs decreased 24% compared with the previous year. And currently, the profit generated by drug trade is more than Afghanistan's state budget, a fact contributing to the spread of corruption to all levels of the Afghan government from the police to parliament.
Because of the transition situation in Afghanistan, the Afghan government has not been able to fully focus on the drug issue, because right now the Afghan government has been busy and preoccupied with the security transition, with economic transition, and with political transition.
As long as the central government remains too weak to improve security in the country, the areas under cultivation would generate huge profit for the drug traffickers. In her recent survey, German researcher Sita Maas suggests that in order to eradicate opium production in Afghanistan, all the politicians involved in the anti-narcotics campaign must be dismissed from their political posts.
As you know, I could not attend your last hearing because I was in Afghanistan, where there are high hopes for a successful election, bolstered by a stronger than expected showing of the Afghan military over the last several months. Yet this optimism is tempered with depressing evidence of persistent corruption, continued wasteful spending, and increased violence.
John F. Sopko, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, believes that the Afghan government must have the political will to combat narcotics, what it is devoid of.
As with the question of the drug, corruption is a multifaceted challenge and problem. So if we tackle the corruption in Afghanistan, it will produce dividend in our ability to tackle the drug issue. So the two are interconnected, as also the question of terrorism, also these another interconnected factors with the drug and with the corruption.
Perhaps the best way to eradicate opium production in Afghanistan is to steer farmers away from drug trade towards alternative, legitimate crops like grapes, wheat, and saffron. Spraying poppy fields is also suggested as another available option for disrupting Afghanistan's lucrative opium market, though chemical spraying has never worked in the Golden Crescent. Experts believe that it is lax security in Afghanistan that gives the Taliban a free rein to cultivate poppies and smuggle drugs.
One important reason for the both the production and the consumption of the drug is the question of poverty. Poverty provides the context, the excuse, and the attractiveness for some farmers in Afghanistan.
The majority of Afghan farmers work for big landlords, and the meager wages they earn are barely enough to get by. What's more, the lack of other viable options makes them work on poppy fields. Some farmers even have to marry their young daughters to their debtors. Opium trade accounts for 35% of Afghanistan's GDP. Against such a backdrop, poppy crop eradication is just chasing a mirage.
This is actually taking your face away from the reality, because they are attacking some other targets for insurgencies and Islamicism and things like that. And international forces, when I talk to them, they say our mandate is not poppy eradication. Our mandate is fight against terrorism. So we will fight against terrorism. They will not touch the farmers or things like that. He said, this is not our mandate.
Needless to say, it's a challenging task to close a Pandora's box of poppy cultivation, opium production, heroin processing labs, and drug trafficking. No doubt poppy cultivation is done inside Afghanistan, but heroin processing equipment cannot be manufactured there. It's no secret that NATO forces in the Golden Crescent turn a blind eye on farmers' activities, at least not to make enemies out of them.
Many people were worried that if international community leaves Afghanistan, there might be a vacuum, there might be a civil war. Therefore, some farmers, mafias, they took advantage of that uncertainty and increased their production.
Experts say that opium production and export have increased considerably since the fall of the Taliban. Foreign forces in collusion with the Taliban have facilitated poppy cultivation and opium production and export to make drug trade in Afghanistan the main source of income for some countries in the world. It's not possible to export such a huge amount of drug from Afghanistan without the involvement of state officials, foreign forces, and international networks. On the 11th of December 2010, the New York Times published an article on the relationship between the United States government and drug lords like Juma Khan. As the biggest and most dangerous drug lord in Afghanistan, Juma Khan was arrested and transported to New York to face charges under a new American narco-terrorism law in 2008. That's while Mr. Juma was a longtime American informer who provided information about the Taliban, Afghan corruption, and other drug traffickers. Along the way, he was also paid a large amount of cash by the United States. According to the article, in his heyday, Mr. Juma Khan was secretly flown to Washington for a series of clandestine meetings with CIA and DEA officials in 2006. John F. Sopko, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, has confessed that the international community has failed in reducing poppy cultivation in Afghanistan and in cutting the Taliban off the drug money. Likewise, US officials believe that they have not been successful in combating narcotics in Afghanistan in spite of the $7 billion budget they spent for this purpose. American experts estimate that the Taliban might have received around $360 million over the past decade. European countries are the biggest consumers of Afghan-produced heroin. Narcotics production in Afghanistan is growing at an alarming rate. Apart from the local Afghans, people in neighboring countries and those located on the transit route used for smuggling those drugs to Europe are affected. Iran shares the longest border with Afghanistan and is the first country on the transit route to Europe. And as a result, it has incurred huge human and financial costs. Iran is at the forefront of a full-scale war against drugs destined for Europe. The more the drugs produced in Afghanistan, the more difficult the job for Iran, and the more the perils against the security of Europe.
In the limelight.
Colorado lawsuit charges group with questioning residents about voting status, while former U.S. President Donald Trump loyalists work to sustain falsehoods about his loss. We have prepared for you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled, Groups Perpetuating Trump's 2020 Election Lie Face Scrutiny and Lawsuits. Conservative groups perpetuating Donald Trump's false charges that the 2020 election was rigged have sparked a lawsuit against one in Colorado and a congressional panel investigation of another in New Mexico over aggressive tactics used to seek out possible voter fraud. The scrutiny and criticism facing these conservative groups underscore how Donald Trump loyalists in several U.S. states are working to sustain falsehoods about Trump's election loss, while launching new drives that voting rights advocates say smack of voter intimidation, often targeting communities of color. A lawsuit was filed by the National Association for Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, and two other groups in March of this year, charging that Colorado-based U.S. Election Integrity Plan, which has echoed Donald Trump's baseless claims about 2020 election fraud, has gone door-to-door in some counties, aggressively questioning residents about their voting status and sometimes bearing arms. Moreover, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform has been investigating EcoMail, a firm that helped push false claims of election fraud in Arizona, and has reportedly been paid $50,000 by a New Mexico county to oversee a local audit force doing intrusive door-to-door voter canvassing. Other states, including Michigan and Utah, boast conservative groups that, under the guise of protecting voting integrity by ferreting out fraud, have been criticized for the methods they employed in seeking out potential voter fraud. Daniel Lang, Senior Director of Voting Rights at the Nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center, said, "As Americans, we expect and demand an open and participatory democracy that welcomes all voters equally." She added, "Those engaging in these pressure tactics should know that voter intimidation is a crime with serious consequences." The lawsuit against U.S. Election Integrity Plan, filed by the NAACP in Colorado, the League of Women Voters in Colorado, and My Familiar Voter, charges that the U.S. Election Integrity Plan has engaged in door-to-door voter intimidation, including taking pictures of some houses in neighborhoods with a large number of minority residents. The lawsuit charges that the U.S. Election Integrity Plan, or USEIP, representatives have at times worn badges or carried firearms when visiting voters' residences, although they are not government officials. Beth Hendricks, the League of Women Voters executive director in Colorado, told The Guardian, "We're very concerned about reports that Colorado voters have received visits at their homes from people sometimes openly armed, posing as government officials who imply, without evidence, that fraudulent voting activity occurred at their address." A Colorado judge recently rejected a motion by USEIP, the U.S. Election Integrity Plan, to dismiss the lawsuit. A separate motion by the plaintiff's two counsels, the nonprofit legal group Free Speech for People and the law firm Lathrop GPM, to obtain a preliminary injunction to halt U.S. Election Integrity Plan's efforts is pending. The lawsuit partly rests on a measure that passed after the Civil War, called the KKK Act or the Ku Klux Klan Act, aimed at stopping white terrorists from using violence to interfere with black voters. The Colorado-based U.S. Election Integrity Plan, or USEIP, which started after Joe Biden defeated Donald Trump, is run by Sean Smith, a retired Air Force colonel who also leads Cause of America, a nationwide group that boasts that its role is to enable, facilitate, and support citizen grassroots action to restore trust in local elections. Mike Lindell, the multimillionaire Trump loyalist, who is the chief executive officer of MyPillow and has been the chief financier of Cause of America, told The Guardian that the group serves as an information hub with a presence in all 50 states and on his website, frankspeech.com. Mike Lindell estimated he has spent between $100,000 and $200,000 monthly for salaries for the group's employees, except for Smith, who is unpaid, and other expenses. Smith was reportedly tapped by Mike Lindell to run Cause of America last fall, after Smith attended a Lindell-organized cyber symposium last summer in South Dakota, which promoted conspiratorial and baseless claims of voting fraud in the 2020 presidential election. An organizing manual for the U.S. Election Integrity Plan thanks Mike Lindell, but he told The Guardian that he had no ties with it. Smith can be seen in a 39-second video clip in a large crowd of Trump loyalists who were at the Capitol during the 6th of January assault, and another photograph that was released by Colorado Newsline and relied on ProPublica research. Smith did not reply to emails sent to Cause of America seeking comment. Other outfits